Welcome to this sermon podcast from the Memorial Church on Emmanuel Road in Cambridge, England. The church website can be found at www.cambridgeunitarian.org. My name is Andrew James Brown, and I'm minister to this liberal congregation, and this is my sermon of the 11th of March 2012, called Upholding the Freedom to Address Our Fate in the Face of the Annulment of Language. As always, the sermon here draws on my own faith and experience, and it is offered to the congregation and to you in this podcast simply as an encouragement to further reflection and thought. It is most certainly not a definitive statement with which you must agree. As my 16th century Polish Socinian forebears said, "Whilst we declare our own opinions, we oppress no one. Let every person enjoy the freedom of their own judgment in religion. Only let it be permitted to us also to exhibit our view of divine things, without injuring and calumniating others." In this spirit, I bid you welcome. There are many things I could have chosen to speak about today, connected with the difficult and occasionally very distressing time my wife, Susanna, had last week, before she was admitted to hospital, where she is now, I'm very grateful, very comfortable, and in good hands. Something connected with pain and its place and role in human existence, as well as how we deal with it both physically and psychologically, was high on my list of possible subjects, but it's proved too difficult to compress what I feel I need to say in the time I've had to write this address. I will simply have to work more on that text before it sees the light of day. But for three reasons, another subject also emerged and shone. Firstly, and most immediately, because so much of the talk within the hospital setting here in the UK, when you're away from the most immediate medical matters, is about how bottom-line numbers rule nearly every aspect of life. The way the health service seems now to be structured and even understood is through the medium of economics. Secondly, there was the fact that the news this week was full of the economic restructuring of the Greek economy, a centralised top-down move that has torn to flinders all normal democratic processes. The third reason relates directly to who we are as a religious community. As I'm sure all of you know, since our tradition's birth in Poland, Hungary and Romania, that's the Socinian forebears I mentioned, these groups in the radical reformation of the 16th century, we stood foursquare against all forms of absolutist dogmatisms. And as I sat with Susanna over those 4 days in accident and emergency, as she drifted in and out of a morphine-induced sleep, I had a long time to reflect on a very dangerous form of absolutist dogmatism present to us today. It's about this danger that I wish to remind us. We may begin by observing that when you are in hospital or any other social entity, it is clear that it is made up of people commingling together who have real feelings and needs which are only able appropriately to be attended to through the medium of language, i.e. by talking to each other, finding out what's showing up to people as being of concern. And this is true even when technical diagnostic apparatus is in use, because in the first place, a patient has to tell a doctor or nurse about this or that pain, which, in the second place, gives a clue about what piece of kit should be used and for what purpose. The results, gained thanks to the technology, then need to be communicated verbally to patient and doctor alike, and a decision needs conversationally to be arrived at about how to proceed. This process is only possible through the medium of language. So, for all the technical knowledge and apparatus being used, a hospital can be said to function primarily in the medium of language. All of a hospital's activities, and the meanings that we associate with these activities, whether good or bad, all of these activities emerge and shine forth from out of the primordial medium of language. On the other hand, the modern economy, and I stress modern because I don't think what I'm about to say ever was thus, but the modern economy has become understood to have emerged not from the creative medium of language, but from the medium of numbers. Of course, language is used by economists, but the tacit belief has developed that beneath the confused and subjective froth of human language, there lies an objective, secure and solid numerical foundation for any of the decisions that are made. So we may say that the economy operates with numbers, whilst the hospital operates with words. In places like hospitals and a church like this, we proceed, as the art and media critic Boris Groys notes, with arguments, programmes and petitions, and also with commands, prohibitions, resolutions and decrees. But, as Groys goes on to observe, so long as humans live under conditions of the capitalist economy, they remain fundamentally mute because their fate does not speak to them. If a human is not addressed by his or her fate, then he or she is incapable of answering it. Economic processes are anonymous and not expressed in words. For this reason, one cannot enter into discussion with economic processes. One cannot change their mind, convince them, persuade them, use words to win them over to one side. All that can be done is to adapt one's own behaviour to what is occurring. Economic failure brooks no argument, just as economic success requires no additional discursive justification. In capitalism, the ultimate confirmation or refutation of human action is not linguistic, but economic. It is expressed not with words, but with numbers. The force of language, as such, is thereby annulled. Here I can return to my earlier point about this church standing in the tradition of the Radical Reformation and its challenge to all forms of dogmatic absolutism. Groys' words, alongside what I was seeing in the hospital and the economic news, reminded me forcibly that we have entered a dangerous time in our history when we are experiencing a concerted effort increasingly to structure our whole society in economic terms. In terms of numbers and bottom lines, with which we are not allowed to talk, let alone argue against. We face a system that is clearly no longer interested in our human fate, but only in its own relentless, impersonal unfolding. Even the people who developed the complex mathematical algorithms that lie behind our modern financial system don't fully understand them. And certainly they have no real control over this system's ultimate behaviour. Our politicians are clearly even more powerless, and they look at us, like rabbits proverbially blinded by headlights, and say, "There is no choice, just look at the numbers." And following an acronym from Maggie Thatcher's days, TINA, they say, "There is no alternative." And we are all told that all they and we can do is to adapt our own behaviour to what is occurring. It goes without saying that despite the rhetoric that we are all in this together, the actual adaptions, by which we mean for the most part the cutbacks, the actual adaptions which are being made are those which suit precisely the same people who've always benefited from the drawing of bottom lines and the counting of numbers. The king was in his counting house counting out his money, and he and his like are still counting out their money. The rest of us are simply told to be quiet and put up with the pain, because that's just the way the universe is. But isn't this uncomfortably close to the situation we rebelled against in the Reformation? Then we simply did not believe that God had ordained the universe in the way the elite told us it was, a way which kept the few wealthy and free, and the majority poor and bound. And we refused to accept a way of being that denied us the right to question the so-called ordained order, or freely to explore alternative ways of being. We discovered in our protest that the Word, the Gospel, the Good News, the Word told us something else, told us something powerful about human freedom, justice, mercy, kindness, and of a self-giving love that had the power to break down all artificial human barriers that kept us being brothers and sisters one to another, and co-workers with God. This, of course, is the model of Jesus. It is important to see clearly that the very thing which constituted us, made us who we are, was a way of being that could only be shared and developed conversationally. The good news first had to be heard by us, and then told to others, who, in turn, had to listen and reflect upon it as we had, and only then, as it was understood by them, could they begin to tell it to others. The authority of the gospel was found only in the telling, the persuasive power of words expressed, and the manner in which it was delivered. It was ever thus. Remember, Matthew and Mark tell us that Jesus simply taught with authority, quite unlike their teachers of religious law. It was just him and his teaching. Anyway, the point is that once listened to, the good news could only be spread by being talked about, reflected upon, told again and again to those who followed, and then modified, reshaped, and creatively reimagined by community after community. It seems indubitably true that for us, in the beginning was the Word, a Word which was always already being incarnated in human actions and behaviours. Of course, we know that at many times, sizable groups within the Christian tradition as a whole have succumbed, and still succumb to, the temptation to turn this free, creative, conversational Word into an absolutist dogma. But the Word itself has never allowed those attempts ever fully to succeed. And we are a living proof of this, and as I've explored on a couple of previous occasions. In our own liberal Christian tradition, we still say that in the beginning was the Word, because we know that if only we can hear it, if we pay attention to the world and what's going on, if we only can hear it, there will always remain the right word to speak, the one properly required for this sentence or this situation. But, and this is a vital point to realize, this same word has also revealed to us that it is the word properly required only for this sentence, not for the next or the next. In its place is the right word, the only right word, but it is not the word of the Lord, nor of any of the philosophical fathers. So the word for us, then, is the strange primordial truth that we are always already within language. It is the medium of our lives, and through it we try to achieve the most abundant life for all, as we persuade each other to embody the Word, by incarnating it in all our actions, and turning it into love. As the writer of 1 John unfolds the process, "Little children, let us love not in word or speech, but in truth and action." And this kind of open, creative, conversational, embodied understanding of the Word, which can persuade us into incarnating love, is what keeps open for us the possibility of remaining free from all dogmas, and where oppression begins again, gives us the power to protest. It seems to me that our commitment to this free, creative, divine and incarnated Word insists that whether or not we are pro or anti certain kinds of general austerity measures, we must all stand up against the dogmatic economic absolutism that says we have no choice but to make our decisions under the absolutist rule of the god of capitalism, numbers. We most certainly do not, for we are sons and daughters not of the number, but of the word. Please remember this, and never forget to speak out for human freedom.